The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we are not going to begin with our normal health and nutrition and environmental updates. That will we do, time permitting, at the end of the program, including new information about the accelerated warming of the Arctic and what the Russian scientists are finding about this and how that is releasing massive amounts of methane. And we will talk about that and why that is important as a part of our environmental series. Also, Bill McKibben has written an article called What Stinks in Washington, and he sees how he was sold out, and so many others were sold out, lied to by the White House and others. And he has written an article this morning on that. Time permitting, I will share that with you. Then we have been flooded from all over the world by people who are saying, what will happen now that the president has flip-flopped and said he will not veto this bill, the defense appropriations bill? We have commentaries from Ralph Nader and many other individuals, Robert Scheer, about, quote, congressional tyranny. The White House surrendered. I would challenge Ralph Nader on this. I don't believe the White House surrendered at all. Based upon what Carl Levin said, I believe that they had always intended for the power of the president to be increased, not lessened. So we will have comments from multiple law professors from around the United States on this, and we are putting up a whole series of articles so that you can keep informed how we can continue to protest. What amounts to, quite simply, if you understand what is involved here, we can say goodbye to the Fifth and Sixth Amendments of the Constitution. And so we will deal with that as we did yesterday. But today I want us to take an in-depth look at the Federal Reserve, why there had to be hidden bailouts to the banks. Why not just let everyone know which banks were getting money and how much and what was the collateral that they were giving? How long were they given to pay this back? What interest rate were charged? And most importantly, what did they do with the money? If they spent it on securing the position of liquidity and to keep their bank from going over the edge, that's one thing. But what if they use that money to buy other banks? So if they were already too big to fail, they became even bigger. What would the American public say about that when no money, not a penny of the initial $700 billion TARP plan went to save the average American's home or small businesses, etc.? I want us to explore that. Also, our austerity policies. We really don't have any austerity policies as such in the United States, but boy, they do in the Eurozone. So I'm going to ask our panel to talk about the effects of austerity in the Eurozone and why the average American just doesn't connect what goes on in Europe with what goes on in the United States. There is reason to know the facts about an association. So we have a lot to share. Our panelist, Professor James Galbraith. He is a distinguished professor and chair of government and business relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas in Austin. He is also the son of the renowned economist who we've had on this program, John Kenneth Galbraith. And James is the chair of the International Organization Economists for Peace and Security and a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute. He also is an author. His latest book is The Predatory State, how conservatives abandon the free market, and why liberals should too. And then we have our second panelist is Marshall Auerbach. Marshall Auerbach is a fellow at the Economics for Peace and Security, a global strategic investment group, and also he has a wide range of experience in global investments and the stock market and the Pacific Rim and Southeast Asia. And he is also an author, and he writes for the Huffington Post, Truth Out, and Naked Capitalism. And he graduated magna cum laude from Queen's University and has a law degree from Oxford. And rounding up the panel will be Les Leopold. He is co-founder and director of the Labor Institute and Public Health Institute. He also helped create the Blue-Green Alliance, an organization that merges labor unions with environmental concerns, such as the Sierra Club. Ralph Nader listed Les's award-winning book, The Man Who Hated Work and Loved Labor, on his recommended top 10 read list. His recent book is The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity. And it's perhaps the single best introduction for anyone who wishes to fully understand the main issues and economic jargon about our economic collapse. And let us begin by going over to, I'm going to start in reverse order with Les Leopold. Nice to have you with us today, Les.
Thank you very much for having me.
Les, I would like for you and then each of our other panelists after you to give your impressions about what has happened in the last several years that is outside the power, even knowledge, of the average American, and how that has negatively impacted them. And I'd like to start with you specifically about the Federal Reserve and what we keep finding out about the bailout. The latest is from an economics group at a university in Brooklyn that the bailout was actually $21 and then $26 trillion. And that's different than Bernie Sanders' Freedom of Information Act, which showed $16.1 trillion, which is different than the earlier $1.1 trillion, which is different than the $700 billion. So people don't realize how much money was actually given to corporations and groups and banks where we have no knowledge and wouldn't have had it been not been for Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, getting this information to us. But nothing has happened because of it. So take us through this whole process of who got the money, how much did they get, what did they do with it, and how that has impacted our economy today.
Well, the fundamental theory that was used by both the Bush White House and the Obama White House and their Treasury Secretaries and the Federal Reserve was at all cost the financial system had to be stabilized immediately, and that no draconian controls should be put on them, that we needed to get them fully functional again. So all kinds of short-term loans, guarantees, were placed on a wide were given to the largest banks because they were virtually, I think, all of them were about to collapse. Now, their theory was you stabilize Wall Street and then the rest of the economy would get stabilized as well and unemployment would come crashing down instead of remaining high and all would be well. Unfortunately, that's not, I think the Obama administration was sold a bill of goods. That's not what happened. Unemployment stayed incredibly high and Wall Street, of course, took advantage of this huge amount of cash inflow and guarantees, for example, guaranteeing their toxic assets. Citigroup got an enormous $300+ billion guarantees. Money markets were guaranteed. They took advantage of this virtually no interest, interest-free money to do what they always do, which is they competitors were bought up with the encouragement of the Obama administration. And as much of this as possible was done away from the prying eyes of Congress. The other big piece of this is that the financiers and their enablers in the administration do not believe that the American public nor their representatives are capable of dealing with high finance. So these things should be done secretly behind our backs. And there's no amount of trouble that could come from having the Bernie Sanders and whatnot stick their nose in this. So apparently they didn't even while they were telling Barney Frank and Senator Kaufman of Delaware, who was trying to come up with legislation to break up the large banks, while they were telling them that basically all was well and just a few adjustments needed to be made, they were in fact not telling them about the trillions of dollars of money and guarantees that were being poured into the banking system. And what I'm afraid, you know, I'm not an alarmist. I don't use words like plutocracy easily. I'm not a conspiracy theory person. But I do think our fundamental notion of democracy is deeply threatened by this growing, the largest Wall Street banks are even larger. Their representatives are basically run economic policy for the U.S. government, and so much of it's done in secret. I think we really have a fundamental threat toward democratic processes.
Let me just cite one of your articles, Six Shocking Revelations About Wall Street's Secret Government, and then I would like for you to respond to these, if you would, please.
Sure.
Here's what your concerns are, and I'll quote you. It's short. The secret Wall Street bailouts totaled $7.77 trillion, 10 times more than the $700 billion troubled asset relief program, TARP, passed by Congress 2008. Knowledge of the secret bailout funds was not shared with Congress even while it was drafting and debating legislation to break up the big banks. The secret funding provided at below market rates gave Wall Street banks an additional $13 billion in profits. That's enough money to hire more than 325,000 entry-level teachers. The secret loans finance bank mergers so that the largest banks could grow even larger. The money also allowed banks to step up their lobbying efforts. While Henry Paulson, Bush's Secretary of Treasury, was informing Congress and the public that only minor reforms were needed to protect Fannie and Freddie from collapse, he met secretly with leading Wall Street hedge fund managers, among them his former colleagues at Goldman Sachs, to alert them that he was about to nationalize the giant mortgage companies, a move that would eradicate nearly all the stock value of those companies. This information was enormously valuable because it allowed these hedge funds to short Fannie and Freddie and thereby make a fortune. And finally, while Timothy Geithner was head of the New York Federal Reserve, he argued against legislation efforts by Senator Ted Kaufman, Democrat of Delaware, to limit the size of banks because the issue was, quote, too complex for Congress and that people who know the markets should handle these decisions. Meanwhile, Geithner was fully aware of the enormous secret loans, while Senator Kaufman was kept in the dark. Now, when you take a look at this, why should the American public be allowing hedge funds or equity partnerships, foreign banks, or even these large banks, to be bailed out, and yet no commensurate effort was made on their behalf?
Well, they shouldn't, and I think we're now facing a crisis where we have to figure out what an alternative looks like to this concentrated banking and financial power. We're down to six major banks. There's probably 100 giant hedge funds that you know have $1 trillion worth of capital floating around in them. That's sort of the shadow banking system. We have to figure out what to do with them, and I no longer believe that the kind of optimistic reforms that I had at the end of The Looting of America that was written 3 years ago, I no longer believe that those will work. I think we need something. I don't think we can just go back to Glass-Steagall and this and that and that it's going to have a lasting impact. I think we need far more draconian reforms if we want to try to actually produce employment for the American public, help people who are underwater, and so on. We can't do both. We can't have a runaway financial system that basically engorges itself and have a just, equitable democracy. And I'm dying to hear what my fellow panelists think, because I think they have done quite a bit of thinking about what a more democratically controlled financial sector might look like.
I appreciate those insights. We'll come back later in the program. Let's go over to Marshall Arbach. Marshall, first, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Would you please address the issue that Les opened up with, that why is it the American public, and for that matter, most people, have been deemed too illiterate to understand finance, and yet at the end of the day, we, the American public, are expected to be the people who bail the Treasury out or any of these other companies out, and yet our needs are not being addressed commensurate to their needs.
Well, it's a very good question, and I can't give you a good answer. I mean, I think that it's a load of poppycock. I mean, there, this notion that you know, we should just leave this to the experts. So this is the kind of government by technocracy that we've had going on in Europe for the last 10, 15 years, and you can see the kind of mess they're in right now. So I think that's just a colossal bit of misinformation. In fact, it's interesting to me that if you compare us to a country like Switzerland, which is home, as you know, to the so-called gnomes of Zurich and has a much larger banking system as a percentage of its GDP than we do. The Swiss National Bank, in fact, insisted on a public accounting of all the mistakes that had been made, and it was released to the public. And lo and behold, the Swiss economy didn't fall to pieces, and they didn't actually have a financial Armageddon scenario occurring there. So this is complete nonsense. So the real reason that the Federal Reserve didn't want these things to be made public is because there is a fundamental notion of fairness here, and it also calls into question all of these fiscal austerian politics that we're being told about right now. We can't afford this, we can't afford that. It's nonsensical. We've literally appropriated trillions of dollars to bail out our financial system, and yet somehow we can't afford to have adequate responses to deal with the more pressing issue of unemployment. So it's just a complete political smokescreen. There's no good answer to why the American people should know about these things.
Last evening, I wanted to see how the different financial programs were handling the daily news. All of them were talking about the good news was that unemployment had dipped down to 8.6% from 9%. And I'm thinking, how can they possibly accept that that official number is accurate when we know for a fact that the real unemployment rate is almost double that, and that if you stop looking for work, you're no longer on any of those lists, and if you work 1 hour a week, you're not on that list. And they don't look at how much you're making. Is if you're employed and you're making $5 an hour, you're employed. And so when McDonald's hired 75,000 people and over a million people lined up to get that job paying minimal wage, those people all became gainfully employed. And so I'm concerned that not even our the face of our economic media is willing to be honest about how severe the issue is. And then today, the U.S. Conference of Mayors released a report showing that, quote, hunger stalks U.S. cities as poverty rises. I'll quote this. A growing number of families in the United States are struggling to put food on the table as poverty rises. The U.S. Conference of Mayors Hunger and Homelessness Survey found all but four of the 29 cities surveyed had major increases in emergency food assistance during the period of September through August. Half of those asked for emergency food were people and families. 26% were employed. Now, that's something we haven't seen before in these numbers. Normally, when people ask for food assistance, they are unemployed. These are employed, but they're employed making so little money. Quote, yep. This is the latest survey to underscore the magnitude of the damage inflicted from the 2007 to 2009 recession. Now, about 24.4 million Americans are either out of work or underemployed, and employment remains 6.3 million jobs below its level in December 2007, and 49.1 million Americans are living in dire poverty, and 13 million children go to bed hungry, and 16% increase in food stamps requests. Now, I'm out across America. I've been traveling for several months now, and this is just immediate past future. I've been working on this film now for 5 years on Poverty Inc. Everywhere I go, I'm meeting people who are working two jobs and still make less money than they used to make with one. I'm finding families where both parents are working and still don't have the income to pay their bills. I'm meeting people who are in home foreclosure or lost their homes and are living in relatives' houses on bunk beds or couches and making up their attic or basement or garage. I've actually been filming people on one street, one single street in one small town. 7 of the 31 houses, they were remodeling some part of the house so members of the family could come back and live there. And yet none of this is being reported anywhere in the American media. And then you look at the number of people who've lost their homes to foreclosure over the last 5 years and bankruptcy. It's 10.2 million, average for family per home. That's 40 million people. And because we don't see them on the streets, we think they're not there. I'm seeing them. I'm filming them. And I'm saying, why aren't we honest about this problem of homelessness, hunger, poverty, affecting the working poor and in America today? And none of this is being talked about or dealt with. And the Fed didn't address this. The banks didn't address this. Our government has not adequately addressed this. I'd like for you and then our next guest to address this, please.
The short answer to your observations is that look who owns the large media companies. I mean, that they are the very same people who are benefiting from the status quo. So the media companies themselves and the large newspapers, the television networks have no interest in exposing the kinds of things that your film is seeking to expose, because it would result in a very significant change in the status quo. And the other point I would make is that you are describing the conditions of what occurs in an economy when it becomes increasingly financialized, when finance starts becoming the handmaiden for industry and manufacturing, and it works the other way around. These are precisely the kinds of trends that you see developing. And I know that your other guest, my friend James Galbraith, has done a lot of work on this, but a lot of people say, well, this is just a function of globalization because places like China and India are opening up. But the evidence doesn't support that at all. Jamie's done a lot of work on this, and in fact, these are exactly the kinds of things you expect to happen when financial institutions and the way that they dominate our economy continue to perpetuate themselves. They perpetuate policies which create precisely the conditions you've designed. And so we need to have a much more robust response, as Les suggested, where you start breaking up these institutions, you restrict their range of activities along the lines of the way one restricts the activities of utilities, because the banks, for example, are public-private partnerships, and you rededicate government towards employment, which is what we used to do in the 1950s and the 1960s and 70s. Now we have this monomaniacal obsession with inflation and to the expense of everything else, and of course anti-inflation policies, when they veer towards disinflation and then ultimately deflation, are benefit precisely the types of people that are the substantial owners of financial assets, the so-called rentiers in our society. So there has to be a very, very significant change on a lot of different levels. Unfortunately, the kinds of policies that I would like to see implemented aren't even being, they're not on the radar of anybody, and I certainly don't see them being introduced by the Obama administration were he to be reelected in 2012.
One more question before we go to Professor James Galbraith, and thank you, Professor Galbraith, for your patience in standing by. When we examine any other business in the United States, or individual for that matter, who's going through a financial crisis, we have laws that allow that person and various forms of bankruptcy to go through a structured bankruptcy and to dissolve a lot of that or forgive a lot of those debts and restructure the ones they have under a plan where they reenter into a working relationship. They have been able, in some cases, to save jobs and repay back debt. But at least the immediate burden is alleviated. Mm-hmm. Why have we refused to acknowledge that the too big to bank, failed banks and other corporations should also have been put through this same process, the Citigroups and Morgan Stanley's and others, and take them through a structured bankruptcy and then get rid of the members who were responsible for those policies that led to that. Let the stockholders take their loss on that, and then have something better and stronger emerge instead of simply bailing them out with nothing changing.
No, I agree with you. Look, the problem is that the very people that got us into this mess in the first place have their fingerprints all over the so-called rescue plan. You know, Tim Geithner, as you pointed out, he's Treasury Secretary now. He was the head of the New York Fed when all of this was going on. There's been no fundamental change in the financial policies of the Bush administration and the Obama administration. The original team of economic advisors that the president brought in were the ones that were champions of this financial deregulation in the 1990s. So, you know, look, the argument always was, well, you know, they're familiar with the financial markets. And, you know, and my response to that has always been, look, if I have a doctor who conducts surgery on me and botches the procedure, I'm not going to go back to him just because he might have greater familiarity with my own body. So, I mean, that's not really an argument. It ultimately comes to a political problem that the people that are in power don't want to make the kinds of changes that you advocate. And the irony is, of course, that there were other alternatives that could have been used. I mean, the argument that you want always hears from the likes of President Obama or Treasury Secretary Geithner is that we had no alternative. Well, of course, they did have an alternative. There were the alternatives that were adopted by the Swedes and the Norwegians in the early 1990s, where they effectively nationalized the banking sector, and the banks were broken up and were restructured. And in fact, if you ask the Swedes where they got this idea from, they will tell you that there's a wonderful little book by Jesse Jones, who headed up Roosevelt's Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and this is exactly the game plan that was followed by the American government under Roosevelt in the 1930s. And of course, it should have been the template for what we did this time. The reforms that were introduced by Roosevelt in the 1930s set the stage for a fundamentally stable financial system for the next 40 years, and that's the way we should be heading. Obviously, there are more modern features, but that's the general thrust that should be adopted today.
One last comment here, please. Recently, we've seen a lot of Jack Abramoff, the disgraced former lobbyist, if not the highest paid lobbyist. He claims he was making $24 million a year. And he said, just two nights ago I saw him, and he said on The Young Turks, on Current TV, if you haven't seen that program, it's really good, and I recommend it. I think they're doing good work over there. He said, I had access to everyone, without exception, from the president down. And he said, it is absolutely implied, if not stated, that when you are giving them money, you have access, and then they will give you legislation that supports your clients. He said that he received, $88 million from Indians, but got them $9 billion in revenue streams because of it. And they never complained about the money they gave, nor the money they made. It was others who, he had too many people he was doing the same business with and undermining one against the other. But he said he stepped over that line. He said, but that line stepped over every day. And well, then that begs the question, since a lot of the money that we are giving to banks, and the Fed is giving to banks, they're able then to hire former legislators, former people at powerful positions and heads of chairpersons of the Commerce Committee and Finance Committee, they walk right in there. We don't have that option. We can't walk into anyone's office. We can't walk into a senator, House member's office. We can't even act as an individual person, a lobbyist. I've tried. You have to wait forever to get to speak to an aide. They didn't have. That money opens the door. Why should we even tolerate this system? Why can't we ban all lobbying and all money going for all political processes if we want to change the system? Otherwise, they have so much money that
well,
they will
and in
always
fact,
be able to control the laws. Your thoughts,
and in fact,
please.
And in fact, I'm familiar with the interview, and one of the other things that Mr. Abramoff suggested was that exactly what you propose, a permanent ban on people from leaving government and then joining the, becoming lobbyists, a lifetime ban. So he's experienced quite a significant Damascene conversion on his own road to redemption. Whether he's serious or not is another matter, but it is a good reform.
Good. Please hold your thoughts. Now let's go over and say hello to our final panelist, Professor James Galbraith. Thank you very much for being with us today.
my pleasure.
First, could you give us your overview on what you see the problems and the solutions to be with our current economic policies? And then I'm going to ask you some specific questions about your thoughts about... I'll just give you the overview now so then you can segue into it as you wish. 7 years ago, I wrote an article after researching the previous 30 years, starting with the Big Five, T. Boone Pickens, Saul Steinberg, Carl Icahn, Ivan Botsky, and Michael Milken, and the junk bonds, and then the corporate raiders, and how it evolved. But during that process, about 24 million jobs had been lost in the United States because of corporate takeovers and mergers and then peeling off and downsizing. No one thought that that was particularly important, and we haven't stopped that policy. And now, how are we supposed to rebuild our country if the very Congress that we're entrusting to do something that is supposed to help Americans is still continuing to support, as President Obama did, more jobs going to India and to China and outsourcing and continuing that because the people in charge of much of our economic policy support that globalization policy? Could you address globalization outsourcing of jobs and why this is not being dealt with, not even protested in any major way?
Okay, I will come to that. I've been listening to the conversation so far, and there are a number of points that have gone by that I'd like to make a few brief remarks about, if you don't mind.
Sure.
On the first issue that came up, which was the size of the bailout, I think it's important to clarify that these very diverse numbers that run from $1.2 trillion up to more than $20 trillion, a significant difference between them is simply the question of whether of how you count loans that turn over on a month-to-month or week-to-week basis. If you treat the stock of debt outstanding as being the number you're looking at, you're going to get a significantly smaller number than if you look at the gross amount of loans that are extended when a loan is repaid and extended again. So that's a major reason why these numbers are vary so much in the reporting. And it's important for people to understand that so that they don't get under the impression that we're in the dark about, in broad terms, that there's an enormous variance in what we know. In terms of the Federal Reserve's propensity for secrecy here, this is a very old story. I was a member of the congressional staff beginning in the middle 1970s when the Federal Reserve didn't even give the Congress its economic forecast, and we had to extract that from the chairman of the Federal Reserve at the time, Arthur Burns, by an act of congressional dentistry that went on for an entire afternoon before we established the precedent that they would tell us what they expected the rate of growth or the rate of unemployment to be. And ever all through the intervening almost 40 years, there have been repeated proposals that the Federal Reserve open up, that it give information, for example, about the minutes of its Open Market Committee meetings and other matters relating to monetary policy. And every single time, the institution claims that the sky will fall, that the Western civilization will crumble, markets will be destroyed if such information becomes public. Eventually, the argument for making it public has prevailed in a number of cases, and of course nothing happens. And a few weeks later, the Federal Reserve comes out practically on clockwork, admitting that, in fact, life will go on pretty much as normal. And that's the situation with the audit bill, which was, I think it's important to note, passed by the Congress and by the Senate, and I think practically a unanimous vote. I don't think, that there were any dissents. And that bill then gave us a lot of information about the details of what the Federal Reserve did during the crisis. And I think it's fair to say that the institution hasn't been impaired. It will continue to go on doing what it does. And we've established once again that there's no downside to increased transparency and openness. Were there some things that that were specifically embarrassing that came out? Yes. Some partnerships and so on that got loans that are very questionable. I think we can continue to examine the terms and conditions that the loans were made under. What's more broadly problematic here, and a number of people have already touched on this, is that there were really two phases to the needs and to the policies. One was to stabilize the financial system to prevent a run, a panic, a complete collapse in which people might lose access to their funds and businesses might lose access to short-term financing that they need, this kind of thing. And you know, that stabilization did occur. Events could have been much worse. And the other was an effective policy to bring about a economic recovery, to keep people in their homes, to get them back to jobs, or to get them to a point where they had stable incomes and that at least were removed from being desperately affected or desperately worried about being affected by the crisis. And that's what hasn't happened, which is why we have this very high rate of unemployment, and a lot of people have dropped out of the labor force. So that's where we are. Was there ever an intent by the administration or the Congress to come up with such a policy? I think the answer to that is no. We don't see any evidence that there was a truly committed effort to first of all, acknowledge the scale of the crisis, to acknowledge the centrality of financial failure and financial fraud to that crisis, and to deal with a crisis in a kind of comprehensive and constructive way that paralleled what Roosevelt did in the early 1930s. Then the question then is, why not? And I think the answer to that is, in part, that our political system has become, in many ways, an appendage of the financial sector. For a very straightforward reason, the financial sector is where the money is. Financial sector profits were about, at the peak, like 40% or so of all profits in the economy. When you have one group of people with that kind of money, well, of course, the political universe is going to turn toward them like sunflowers toward the sun. And there is really no way to avoid that unless you address that fundamental dominance of the sector. I mean, the reality is that someone who serves in public life, who may be in his 40s or his 50s, whether you're talking about the former chairman of the director of the Office of Management and Budget, or the president himself, looking ahead at their future life, they have to ask, where do I want to work? What's the most lucrative profession? And the answer is always going to come back, banking. And so you have high officials already in this administration going off, not necessarily to lobby, but to become senior officers in major banks. And that that possibility, they weren't unaware of it beforehand. And they think it's clear that that's going to condition the kind of policies that they pursue. And it's, you know, you can go down the list of high officials, and you know how well they do after they've served in public office very much depends upon whether they pick up employment in the financial sector afterwards.
Okay. Well, could you give us your insights on what you see the challenges to the average person trying to get a job where maybe for years, not maybe, I've interviewed over 2,000 who had a living income. They were able to pay their bills. They were not in debt. They had a savings of anywhere from 7 to 15%. And now they're stacking boxes at Walmart or flipping burgers, including a person I just interviewed, filmed yesterday, who has two master's degrees and is an engineer and couldn't find work and now is living out of their car. And so they, when they're competing, they're competing in jobs that are now frequently someone is making $4 a day in Mexico or $3 a day in another country like India. They can't compete with that. So they're looking and saying, how in the world am I going to get a job back when the job I used to have and many of the others are gone? And they're not coming back. We haven't had a shift in bringing jobs back to America or a living wage or corporations wanting to do more to share much more of their profit with their workers to help them be better. They're giving it to their the people who are invested in their corporations. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think to begin on this issue, we need to acknowledge that we are only one country in a wider world, and some of the players in that world are very big and very independent. China has maybe 20% of the world's population, India comparable amount these days. So those countries are going to do what they're going to do, and we need to take that as a fact of life. That said, there is no excuse for failing, as we have been failing, to provide decent employment at decent wages for people who live and work in this country. It's a question of figuring out what it is that needs doing and setting up the institutional structures that will provide those jobs. You know, when Roosevelt set out to deal with the massive unemployment of the 1930s, and unemployment which was to a very substantial extent displacement of farm workers from the land by the Dust Bowl, by mechanization, and by the collapse of demand for farm products. He didn't say we're going to go back and make the farms competitive. He put people into the Civilian Conservation Corps. He put people into the Public Works Administration, the Works Progress Administration, the Tennessee Valley Authority. It built up the country in a way which gave us a vastly higher living standard than we'd ever had before or would have had otherwise. And that's what we need now, is not to think about, I mean, we can regret the jobs that are lost, but we need to be realistic about manufacturing, for example, manufacturing particularly of consumer goods, where if the Chinese are going to make 4 billion pairs of shoes a year, there's just nothing we can do to stop them. But that's all right. We ought to be thinking about and effectively finding ways to provide employment for the people we actually have on the problems that we actually need to face. We have a vast problem of climate change. We have a vast problem of energy conservation requirements. We have a vast problem. We have the aging population that needs care. We have neighborhoods that are crumbling that need to be preserved and protected. We have all kinds of issues that we can usefully put people to work on. We can certainly provide small businesses with the financing that they need to keep operating. We can do all kinds of things if we simply had a government that was dedicated to actually finding solutions rather than one which, as I said before, was focused like sunflowers to the sun on the sources of its of not only its current campaign money but its future personal incomes.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you. One last question for each of you, please. I'm going to go back to Les Leopold, and then I'm going to ask the same question of Marsha Auerbach. I'm concerned that Americans are not really that aware of what's happening in the Eurozone, how many countries there are, how many are using their currency, and what it means to have a percentage of debt that they have to service compared to their gross domestic product. And just a quick overview from my perspective. We, meaning the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and other groups, have bailed out, but at a very high cost, and with structural adjustments in Greece, Spain, Ireland, and now Italy, and Portugal, and there'll be others. But what we're asking is that we're going to help you. We're going to help you have money to pay back the banks or the lending institutions. In return, we're going to ask you to go through an austerity program. In Greece, 20% of your pensions will be cut. We're also going to privatize many of your assets and things that you've been able to get for free in the past, such as water in Greece and Spain. Now it's going to be privatized and you'll have to pay for it. And we're used to get to drive a ride on public transportation. If you're a senior citizen, now you have to pay, and so on. And so on the one hand, the banking community says, good, you know, they've accepted this and we've put technocrats in positions who are able to steer this austerity program and who are able to give them this poison pill. But as an activist, a social activist who has helped support or lead many different movements, there's two ways of looking at it. Yes, initially, you're going to get the austerity programs passed. Then everyone on Wall Street's going to say, hurrah, hurrah. But spend some time with me, sitting in someone's home, who's never protested, who has never had a strong position one way or the other about government or banks. They just kind of go along to get along. But now they don't have enough money to feed their family, take their medicines, pay their utilities or rent, and they have to give something up. They had never had that before. How long will they tolerate that kind of give them the medicine that kills the patient? And I believe that that's what's going to happen. I'm going to go on a limb and say that I'm going to see, from what my feedback is, I'm going to see, I believe, in the next year, in Greece, then Spain, Ireland, and Italy, some major pushbacks by unions, people wanting to throw the people who pass these austerity measures out of office once they see that they will stay in these austerity modes for a long period of time, and in most cases will get worse. And yet in the United States, in the media, in almost everywhere you look, the emphasis upon good news, stock goes up, good news, Wall Street rebounds, based upon the stability of Merkel and Sarkozy coming to grips with this. And I'm thinking, Merkel and Sarkozy are not having to count the food that they're eating. They're not suffering. You put people, normal people, nonviolent people, in a position where they must struggle and their children must suffer. Sooner or later, they will react. And we have no one talking about the capability of what could be the downside of the austerity programs there and how that might impact us here. So, Leslie Apol, could you address this? And then, in turn, each of the other gentlemen, at what you see happening in Europe and what you see could be the implications or consequences in the United States. Thank you.
Yes. The way I look at this is in terms of two competing frameworks or narratives. Until very recently, the dominant narrative that kind of took over was, I'll quote Marshall, the deficit hysteria, the idea that borrowing was getting out of control and people had a type of, they were living over their heads. And that was the narrative of you bought the house, too big a house that you can't afford, and that somehow the profligate government, the profligate individual was the fundamental cause of the economic crisis. And it was as if financial amnesia set in, or Alzheimer, where we just forgot that it was Wall Street run wild with its financial instruments, its incredible gambling that literally took down the economic system. It's like we forgot that. So one narrative is the one that kind of views Europe as this another, you don't want to be like Greece, right? It's a profligate operation, and everybody has to tighten their belt. What's happening now, however, is the second narrative has finally emerged a little bit. And that, I have to thank the kids in Occupy Wall Street. By calling something Occupy Wall Street, it creates the 99% framework, it creates a narrative that says, wait, the 1%, the fraction of the 1%, they took down the economy. They caused this massive amount of unemployment. They should contribute mightily to precisely the kinds of programs that Jamie's talking about, exactly those kinds of programs. That narrative is necessary to get from here to those kinds of programs. And that competition is what people like you and people like who are the economists on this show and many, many others have to get out into public, in the public view. Otherwise, the deficit hysteria, it kind of has a natural life. It's easy to promote, and it's the wonderful Wall Street narrative because it takes the spotlight off of them, and it's basically saying you have to sacrifice, tighten your belt to resurrect an economy that, you know, we destroyed. And once that narrative is exposed and the other narrative is put forward, you have a chance, perhaps, of a populist resurrection that may have the power to change the course of the country. It's a war between two frameworks and two narratives.
I appreciate your insights. Thank you. Marshall Arbeck, your thoughts, please.
Agree with a lot of what Les said, in fact, all of it, and I agree with what you were saying earlier. The reality is that what I have told people, the relevance as far as Europe goes to the U.S. is that if we start embarking down this path towards greater fiscal austerity, that we will continue to see greater economic contraction. Now, of course, Europe has very, very different institutional arrangements than we do. I won't go into the details of that, but what I will say is that clearly, when you start deflating your economies into the ground, and you will start seeing the tax revenues go down, social welfare expenditures go up, and lo and behold, your public deficits go up. So, in fact, this whole embrace of fiscal austerity, if the objective is to reduce public deficits, and I don't think that is a reasonable objective, but if that is what your objective is, then it's very counterproductive. All you are doing is actually making the problem worse. It's like an economic equivalent of medieval bloodletting, and we're going to see more of that. Like you, I think that you're already starting to see riots on the streets in places like Athens, Madrid. Spain, youth unemployment is 45%. You've got double-digit unemployment rates in places like Portugal, Greece, Italy, and people's stock of household savings are starting to deplete. And by the way, Italy, as a country as a whole, is not a particularly profligate country. It has a much lower levels of private debt than most of the European countries do, and they have no mortgage debt to speak of. So again, the narrative is very, very skewed towards government debt, which is not a problem per se. So I do think that you will get more social instability, and that's the sort of thing that will ultimately change the trajectory of policy in Europe. If it doesn't, then you will just continue to see more blood on the streets, and you ultimately see the European Monetary Union fracture, and that will create a huge collapse in living standards for a lot of people across Europe and will impact on us as well.
Thank you. And Professor James Galbraith will conclude our interview with your thoughts on this. And do you see austerity measures being enacted by this, either the current administration or the next one after the elections, that will start forcing Americans to cut some Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and other programs to be very similar to that which is occurring now in Europe?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. I think that Europe does have some special political and economic disadvantages, of which perhaps the most general one is that people in the countries which are most strongly impacted and destroyed, in fact, by the austerity policies don't vote in the countries that are making the decisions. So that Greece is being destroyed, its education system, its public health system, its infrastructure just being wrecked. But the Greeks have no voice in Germany or France, where the decisions are actually being taken. And I think that we do have a fighting chance in this country if people will recognize that Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are enormously important assets. They're insurance programs. They're sustainable. They're very efficient. They're much better than the private companies would offer in their stead. And they are subject to an enormous propaganda barrage, which can and should be resisted, and so far has been largely resisted. It's still something which threatens and continues to threaten, but can, be fought off. What is happening in Europe, I think, is in some ways worse than your characterization of it, though, because what you see in the politics, let's say, of a country like Greece, is that the party that happens to be in opposition at the moment always is opposed to the austerity programs that are being imposed by whatever party happens to be in power or claims to be opposed. But it's an entirely dishonest opposition, which will evaporate if the parties change position and the out-of-power party comes into power. And there is no effective voicing in Europe of the reason why these policies are destined to fail. In fact, they're intended to do things other than provide economic recovery in Europe. They're intended to protect the North European banks, to protect the parties in power in Northern Europe, to protect Chancellor Merkel's party and President Sarkozy's party, to protect the euro as an institution, not to provide the basis for economic recovery in Greece or Italy or Spain or Portugal or Ireland. And so it's not accidental that those recoveries are not happening. But there is effectively, you know, the people can go out on the streets in Greece. They do. The last time I was there, the air traffic system, the entire air traffic system in the country was shut down by a protest strike. But that doesn't mean that they have a clear, effective, articulated, organized political means to respond to it. I think in some ways we're closer, we have more potential for developing that here because, as I say, there are many people who are protected in ways that they understand are extremely important by the existing institutions, by Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. If they stay organized, stay alert, keep fighting, they still remain a powerful political force.
I thank you. And all of you, Marshall Auerbach, Professor James Galbraith, Les Leopold, thank you all very much for sharing with us today in this forum.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Gary Knoll. Now we're going to take for those of you who are listening over the Progressive Radio Network now, we're going to take the next 5 minutes to get your feedback, your thoughts, your input. It's a very complex issue, but give us a call at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We'd like to hear from you right now. Please give us a call. Join me in studio is Elizabeth and Jason. Hi, Elizabeth. Hi, Jason.
Hello, Gary. Here's something that's sort of related. It's something that came out earlier in the week, but basically the Telegraph reported that British embassies in the Eurozone, quoting here, have been told to draw up plans to help British expats through the collapse of the single currency. And the ministers are saying it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. It's just a matter of time. And they believe that it's going to mean the banks will literally collapse, people won't be able to draw their money out of the banks, and there'll be actual physical rioting. So this is something that you'd predicted a year ago, and in light of this, what do you predict now, please?
I predict that you cannot get out of a crisis by constant contraction. That would be like a person being 300 pounds and you simply starve them for 6 months. The person dies, but they lost some weight. This whole concept of expansionary fiscal contraction is a myth, and it won't work. What you have to understand is that right now in Athens, as well as in Dublin, you have massive scenes of poverty you have not had before, not in this last, let's say, 50 years. Every block you'll see homeless people. They're curled up in doorways. In Spain, all their emergency housing has been shut. And in Italy, you'll see store after store after store closed. So if you don't have the money to buy things, then consumption falls. And as my guest said, as consumption falls, then the people who needed to have you buy something in order for them to pay their 2 or 5 or 20 employees can't pay their bills, can't pay their rent, and so they close. And then those people are out of work. And this is particularly true in Italy, France, and less so in Ireland. But the entire real estate market collapsed in Spain. The whole economy was a bubble economy. It's true also in Ireland, less so in Italy. Now on top of that, you have layer upon layer upon layer of corruption, favoritism, cronyism, nepotism within each of the ruling administrations in all those countries. And they're not the ones suffering. The people who relied upon them are suffering. So now just imagine a bank comes in and says, well, we're going to demand that you pay us every nickel that we invested, 100% return. We're going to charge you 6.5 to 7.5 6.5% interest, 7.5 if it's 2 years, 6.5 if it's 1 year interest. And we're going to make you pay for water and sewage and other things you never paid for before. And exactly how are the people who are already without cash going to pay for this? So it's counterintuitive and counterproductive. So when these austerity programs are implemented, and when people start to see that they can't live with this, and when they've been used to having a month vacation in Italy and Spain, and now they can't have any vacation at all, what do you think is going to happen? They're first going to have their unions. They're going to say, you promised us. So the unions then, to save face, are going to have to go on strike. So multiple general strikes will occur. By the way, in the United States, where are the unions? Oh, they're in the White House, and they're backing Obama, and they're trying to co-opt Occupy Wall Street. But why haven't they called a national strike? If we don't want to be given a physical pat-down and have our body, in effect, physically, sexually assaulted, then why haven't we called a general strike? Not to fly across the country. We could. We're not used to doing things that push back in a major way. And the unions have completely let us down because they've been so corrupted at the top by various givebacks to the leadership that hasn't kept itself in power by its members saying, see what we got? But why haven't you used the power of that union to stop things that all of us agree are wrong? Why haven't you protested and gone on general strike against the wars or the current law that they're now that is going to allow Americans to be arrested and detained and have our Fifth and Sixth Amendment completely taken away? Where are these? You'll see it in Europe. You'll see it in Greece, Ireland. The biggest riots will come in Greece. The second biggest riots will come in Ireland because the temperament there is extremely hostile towards the people who were supposed to be bailing them out. So I see a major crisis throughout much of the Eurozone, and I see the Euro crashing and unless they cut some of these countries out and then redefine the Euro and redefine who's allowed in it. That's all the time we have. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Noll. Stay tuned for Mike Fader, right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
The Gary Noll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tattenfeld.